Welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, host of World Poetry Open Mic, The Michael Amade Show, author of more books than I should mention, musician, poet, and above all, creative entrepreneur. My collaborator and conspirator in this project is Clifford Brooks, the founder of the Southern Collective Experience, poet, and author of The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, Exiles of Eden, and Athena Departs, A Gospel of a Man Apart, and he does so many other things as well. In this episode, Cliff and I interview Cameron Deason-Hammond. Her writing appears in the KISS anthology from W.W. Norton, Echo Tone, The Literary Review, The Houston Chronicle, Nylon, and elsewhere. And her essay, Infirmary Music, was named a notable in the Best American Essays 2017. She earned an MFA in creative writing from Seattle Pacific University and is a writer in residence for writers in the schools in Houston, where she lives with her family. Her debut book, This Is My Body, a memoir of religious and romantic obsession, will be published on October 22, 2019 from Lookout Books. Without any further ado, here's our interview with Cameron Deason-Hammond. All right, and here we are. I'm here with Clifford Brooks, and our guest today is Cameron Deason-Hammond. She is an author. Of course, I've just given her bio, but I want to first kick it over to Clifford Brooks, who, of course, brought Cameron to us, and kind of have him start this conversation. Take it away, Cliff.
Cameron, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. How are you this afternoon?
Yeah. Thank you for asking. I am fine. I've just been sitting in traffic for an hour, to be totally honest. I am fine. I'm quite well.
There should be some tension, I would think, because when I looked over your bio, now originally I got to know you through a mutual friend, Luke, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and your work was published in the Blue Mountain Review that came out last month, but I had no idea you had so much going on. 7 self-produced albums. You run a podcast called The Ish, and you have a memoir coming out this October. How in the world do you balance all that? And family and a job. How do you balance all these? Tell us about this stuff.
I don't balance. I'm a mess. I'm a wreck. As I said, I've been sitting in traffic. I'm pulling my hair out. I don't know how I balance it. I think that the more activity going on, sort of the better everything goes. It's just kind of my personality. So I've always been a bit of a multitasker. And yes, the music is, so it goes in seasons too, obviously. So a couple of years ago, I put out a record. I think the last record I put out was 2017, which was a live jazz, kind of a jazz Southern gospel album. And then the year before that, I put out a covers record. So I did a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing and spent 2 years really focused on writing. And then the second that I got out of that program, I had to make an album or two. So I did that, and then I wrote the book. And so it's a bit of crop rotation, really. It's not all happening all the time. So right now I'm more focused on the podcast and more focused on the book that's going to come out in 5 months. And music is just kind of there. I'm not recording anything new right now. So yeah, I mean, I think you just kind of have to rotate the crops. So
I love that phrase, the rotate the crops. We've had people on the show before that are multi-talented, and they've said in different terms exactly what you are. How does the writing on the page to the songwriting, to the interviews, when you rotate them, how does the creativity feed upon itself?
You know, I think that as a writer, I'm very interested in writers. So I started the podcast when my book was on submission. My memoir was out in the world, hoping to find a home. And that period of 5 months was incredibly stressful. I don't know if you've experienced that or not, but it's sort of like, you know, you create this thing and you put it out, and my agent, you know, put it out to many, many editors, and you just sort of like hope that all of the work you put into it will pay off and that someone will, you know, find value in it. But it was a long waiting period for me, and I was going crazy. So I was like, I need to do something. And my friend Luke, who hosts, he's like a podcast like Don. He has like 50 podcasts that he produces, but he was like, why don't you do a podcast? And so I was able to channel some of that like energy and anxiety that I had from just waiting to hear about my own work into talking to other writers about their work. And I was writing and editing and revising a memoir. So I was interested in talking to memoirists because I wanted to know what they knew. You know, I was interested in learning from them. So it all, you know, feeds itself. And it was incredibly helpful for me not only to talk about structure, like how did you structure your memoir? What did it, you know, what structure did you choose? And how did you come upon that idea? But also the publishing process, you know, hearing from writers about, you know, agent querying and, you know, press querying and their own experiences of having books on submission. And, you know, how do we all make a living while we're doing all this and all of those things. And it was just really, like, again, it kind of gave my creative writing brain a break, and also allowed me to think about the professional side of things. And I learned a lot, you know, so, and then it's, I don't know, the songwriting, I started writing, co-writing music with my, my brother has a, had a band for many years called the Damwells, who were a bit of a cult success. And he and I and my husband, the last like original project I did was a band called the Rebecca West that we co-wrote everything together. So I had been writing my own songs and then we started co-writing. And so now I sort of feel like I need a co-writer. And so that's kind of why the songwriting is a bit on hold, because I'm focusing, I guess, on things that I can do totally on my own, which is for now podcasting and writing. So I don't know if that answers your question or if I just went off a tangent, but
no, tangent. I found that tangents are where the truth is. I found that to be an absolute gospel fact. And you brought up something that's the reason why we created this podcast. And we've gone off again on long tangents our own, Mike and I, about the importance of community at all stages of writing. Yeah. As you created the Ish, Is the Ish building that same kind of community and sharing that information? Is that kind of the crux of what you do with that?
It really is. I mean, it's the whole idea of literary citizenship is really important to me. And, you know, when you're, you know, working on your first book and you don't know anyone and you're, you know, sort of unsure of the literary world and what it all entails, you know, a sure way to, you know, create community is to help other people. And, you know, whether it's, you know, a small thing or a big thing or sharing a post or whatever it is. And so I believe in that profoundly, and I've seen it work, you know, and not just because people are supporting me or will support me, I hope, but because it's just, it feels good to help people. And it also, I've learned so much, you know? So yeah, community is everything, I think, you know, especially in the beginning of a career. And I mean, I hope always, but especially in the beginning for sure.
Did you find any pushback or hard walls to climb as far as breaking into a community, or did it seem to, when you, I mean, my mind's kind of racing right now. You've hit so many good points. The promotion with Abandon, you know, what I hear you saying is that to see other people doing good stuff and really not expecting anything in return of them to promote you, but to set up that energy. Once you had that energy of acceptance out there, did you hit any walls with that? Did you get any pushback?
No, I don't think so. I mean, as far as like trying to find your way into, you know, into a community, I think that's a good question. Like, it can feel cliquish. So I have talked about this, but I've been a part of a secret Facebook group for like 5 years, and so I can't tell you about it. I'd have to kill you if I told you. but it's for writers, and it's for women. So it's a women and women identifying writers. And that community was a total equal playing field. So we had people from, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, National Book Critics Circle Award winning, like all the award winning, to like grad students, to undergrad students. So it was a total range of, you know, everyone at every stage. And it was created to give women an opportunity to share resources with other women, because women are traditionally underpublished and underrepresented. And I just couldn't believe how lucky I was that happened right as I was sort of, you know, finishing my master's degree, that community kind of came about, you know? So that there was no barrier to entry there for me because I was invited in, right? But, you know, like I said, it's a secret Facebook group. But I think also, like, you know, I think there's this thing that we do or artists do or I do where you sort of like look, you know, have your nose against the glass and you're like, oh, look, they've all got it figured out. And, you know, they're all like getting their work published in the Paris Review and that will never be me. And all of, you know, all of the kind of envy and self-doubt that happens. And I've done tons of that, but I have found in this community of women writers and then, you know, beyond that, just this simple sort of, you know, giving not to get back, but just to create community is, it just works. You know, and if people like aren't into your stuff, then that's fine. They're not into your stuff, but I haven't really had any, I haven't found really any pushback. I just figure like if someone doesn't want to be my friend, like that's okay. They have their own life and
exactly.
You know
exactly.
What I mean? Like it's not, yeah, but.
Because Mike and I have heard words like, you know, lucky and fortunate, but and I believe that on a larger scale, that those ideas are what keep people humble. And ultimately, I believe that it's the humility that draws in all this positive attention. When you mentioned, and I'm not going to bang, I don't want to know names. I don't want to die. I don't want to know the group. But when you had some of the bigger names come in there, did you find all of them to be tremendously humbling and humbled and helpful?
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
Now, I want to get to the heart of this before I stop monopolizing this entire conversation and shift it over to Amade. Your memoir, This Is My Body, a memoir of religious and romantic obsession. Tell me about that, please.
Okay. I shall tell you about it. I shall tell you about it without reading the jacket copy because I wrote it, so I should be able to talk about it freely. So I wrote a memoir about a period of my life that was very difficult, where my sort of religious, you know, idealism and my marriage hit a wall at the same time. I was a very unlikely convert to a sort of version of Christianity that at the time was very unusual, but now is not. It was sort of a creative bunch of hippies from England who turned out to be sort of evangelicals who were started a house church in Brooklyn. My coming to faith was not, I wasn't raised in it. I was raised essentially agnostic. But I came to faith in this very dramatic way. And at the same time made a marriage in the wake of this very zealous conversion. And so like 15 years later, as you have, you know, I hit a wall. I mean, some people buy a Porsche when they have midlife crises. I, you know, kind of burned everything to the ground, you know, spiritually and emotionally, that was happening in my life. About my beliefs, about love, about God, about spirituality, and all these things. And so I started out writing a book about my conversion because I grew up Jewish and, you know, sort of like witchy, agnostic, like hippie kid, and realized that I was just not really interested in writing that book. And so I started to write about what was happening at the time, what I was going through at that time. And, you know, I developed I had a relationship, an emotional relationship with someone who is not my husband that, kind of made all of this come into sharp focus and we were in crisis. And so as I was taking apart my religious beliefs, I was also taking apart my beliefs about marriage and love. And I found that they're incredibly similar. I found that the way that we fall in love with a person is also the way that we fall in love with God often when we do have religious experience like that. Even when you have an emotional relationship with someone or a relationship with someone that's over, you know, email or whatever, like letters or, you know, the person is not there, right? Not physically in your space. And that's also like our relationship with God, right? God is invisible. And is also a construct of our, you know, spiritual and creative imagination. So I was interested in the way those two passions can mirror each other and what happens when they both fall apart. And so that's what the book is about. It's about kind of my journey through a crisis of faith, my one of my wonderful blurbers, the poet Nick Flynn, called it A Dark Night of the Soul, which is a great, you know, a great way to talk about it. It really was that. But like The Dark Night of the Soul written by St. John of the Cross, you know, the darkness, the descent into darkness is a movement toward light, is a movement toward, you know, God, whatever we believe, you know, God is, the divine, whatever it is. So it ultimately really is a story of hope. And, you know, about kind of how I started to rebuild those things after having to come to a place of crisis with them. But I think it has a happy ending. So
I love doing this. Obsession. How does the obsession play in between the two?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, because again, when I look back, I mean, you know how we have these Facebook memories that pop up on Facebook to tell you like the stupid shit you were saying 10 years ago online, right? When I see those, I literally from 10 years ago, when I was in the height of my like religious obsession, you know, the things that I was posting and the way that I was talking, the things that I was saying, I don't even recognize that person, you know? And I know that it was pure in my heart at the time. Like but when I see that stuff now, I'm just like, oh my God. So, I mean, obsession is really when you're laser focused on a thing, you know, to the detriment of all else, including yourself and who you really are. And we can, when we fall in love with a person, this happens so quickly and easily because it's like you're a person, you have a life, you've got things going on, you meet a person, they have a life, they have things going on, and all of a sudden, you know, when that thing happens, whatever that thing is between two people, you can so easily lose yourself in that other person. You start to become what you think they want, right? Which is ironic because they wanted who you were before you were with them, right? So, and it's the same thing with God, I think. I think that like I found God and then I changed everything about myself. I thought that everything about myself had to change to fit this image of what I thought a good Christian was. And now with 15 years of, you know, hindsight, it's heartbreaking to me. But it's also okay. You know, it's also like, it was a growth thing. It was a thing that I had to do. I had to completely reinvent myself and then take that all back down to the studs again, you know, to figure out who I was before all that craziness. So, I mean, again, that's a bit of a tangent, but that's what I think. I think obsession, that's what obsession is. Yeah.
Well, this is a good start. I haven't said anything really yet since the beginning, but this is good. So, so Cameron, I have some questions. I'm going to kind of go a slightly different direction here. So I did some reading and some research in your work before this, as you should. And I came across a subject that I really thought I was one of the few people who knew about, which is thanatology. And Therese Schroeder-Schecker. And I saw your essay, Infirmary Music, and as a musician myself, and as a writer, as a poet myself, and as someone who's really spent time in the world of hospice as well.
This was
pretty powerful. And the thing I'm going to add before I ask you about this is when you begin your essay, you're talking about Sarah, and who was 26, and she had sarcoma in her arm. Now, just as a quick thing, when I read this, it kind of jumped out at me because when I was 10 and 11 years old, I had osteosarcoma in my left arm.
Wow.
And kind of was very lucky and had less than a percentage of a chance of survival and came through it. And so reading that and then seeing the connection of something that I didn't really realize anyone else was paying attention to is really powerful. And so I wanted to lead off by asking what kind of first brought you into this kind of focus that you put in infirmary music? I mean, this is a very specific idea told through various stories. What was kind of the journey that made you suddenly say, I'm going to write this essay?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it was the fear that I couldn't keep doing it anymore. Honestly, it was a so the where the essay begins is with Sarah, but where it ends is, you know, with me kind of walking away from someone who might have wanted or needed me to sing for them. And, you know, I wrote the essay because I felt so much, just so many conflicted emotions about that, because I sort of fell into this practice of singing for people as they were dying. So we say thanatology, we're talking about death, right? The kind of the study of death, or the combination of music and end of life care, which is very specific and different from, as you know, different from like music therapy, right?
Absolutely. Because
the goal is not to heal. The goal is to aid passage, right? And I didn't know any of that. I was just a singer who worked for, like, sang at a church, and Sarah was a part of the congregation there. And so someone asked me to go and sing for Sarah. And then it became a thing that I became known for. So people would call me to do these kind of vigils, and it kind of wrecked me, you know, And, I wasn't studied about it. I wasn't trained, and I wasn't prepared. So all of the Tree Schroeder Checker stuff, which is interesting, I actually found her through an Amy Hempel short story.
Okay.
Which I don't know.
Yeah.
So Amy Hempel has a short story in one of her collections, and she mentions this woman who does this, you know, incredible work with dying people through music. And I was like, who is this woman? I mean, I think the story was published in the 80s. So I tried to track her down, and then I educated myself about that work. But yeah, I wrote it because I wanted to understand it, and I wanted to, I think we, with essay, I think essayists, or most essayists, are working toward a question. I didn't know what the answer was, but I had a question, you know, and the question was, can I keep doing this? So that's what it was.
I think, you know, I remember Bob Dylan at one point had said something akin to, there's two kinds of music, living music and dying music. And it seemed like a quip, you know, because he's known for being very quippy. But I think there's a lot of depth to that. And I kind of had a similar experience, but it wasn't so much at in the hospice kind of world. And I wasn't practicing that specifically, but singing and performing a lot of funerals. And I started realizing more and more that the sense and the essence of death started taking more and more place in my in the music and the creative process. And so I can completely understand what you're talking about as far as needing to kind of make a choice. Where is your music? Is it living music? Is it dying music? Is it, what is it? So I appreciate you opening up and taking the time with that.
Yeah.
Now, to completely flip, because, you know, being podcast guys as Cliff and I are, we're always very interested to find out kind of the ideas behind, you know, the overarching idea behind a podcast, and then kind of what some favorite moments are. So what was the overall idea behind the Ish podcast? And then how did you go about formulating that and developing it?
Yeah. So as I said, I started it when my book was on submission. So I was like in a, you know, existential crisis.
Need motion, motion. Yes.
Yeah. And it was also not long after the 2016 election, and I felt like, as it is still, that most of the conversations that were happening and are still happening are happening in binary. It's everything is yes, you know, us and them, in or out, black and white. And you know, I'm a liberal progressive Democrat, and always have been. However, I live in a world of, we live in a pluralistic world. I live in a pluralistic world. And I wanted to find a way to talk to people about the unresolved parts of their lives, the tensions, you know, the ish, right? So the ish is like the in-between. And originally I wrote an essay for the Houston Chronicle some years ago, a little bit before this, called Evangelical Ish. And so it was like the beginning of me trying to understand my, you know, how I could continue to call myself a Christian and yet abandon all of the, you know, political conservatism of evangelical Christianity, you know?
Sure.
And so I was interested in that in terms of thinking about it in my own life. But then I thought, when I was talking to my friend Luke, who is my producer, you know, what if we opened it up to just the ish in everything, in politics, love, religion, art, you know, the areas of tension. And you kind of find that, or I found that most conversations worth having are are being had over an issue that is unresolved. That's why we're talking about it, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about things that are, are gray, the gray area, not the black and white, not the easy answers, but kind of the stuff that needs to be worked out. So that was the idea behind it.
You see, the thing I think I find is really fascinating about this on a deeper level is, you know, you're talking about how the a relationship between two people can be very similar to the relationship with God, or the relationship with, you know, however you want to say it, the divine or existence or whatever, that in a way you're still almost kind of minding that. It's almost the ish in that concept is almost like the space between two people touching, or the space between a person and God. You know, there's that gray open space.
Yeah.
That's pretty fascinating stuff. And I really think that's cool. Cliff, do you have anything? I mean, I've been kind of going a little deep here. Do you have any thoughts, any practical things you want to pull into this?
I want to springboard off what you're talking about. And then, you know, practical, I think being a pivotal word here is that I love the ish talking about, I think that it's impractical that people have labeled understanding themselves and how they feel about faith and dealing with the things that they find uncomfortable. There's a therapeutic practicality to talking about these things.
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
That's what fascinates me about the ish. When you've had the podcast thus far with the ish, have you witnessed to a degree kind of breakthroughs in people as they talk about these things with you?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be so presumptuous as to say, you know, that everyone's having breakthroughs on my show, but, I have certainly seen, you know, aha moments in writers as we're talking, and I've had them, as I'm talking to other writers. I had the privilege of interviewing Dani Shapiro. I did a live event with her a couple months ago. And, you know, because I'm like a weirdo who's interested in religion, I grew up like agnostic Jewish. My dad's Jewish. My mom was Catholic. So I was like always this in-between kid, which again is part of my interest in the ish. I led off with a question for her about Judaism and about her relationship to Judaism in light of learning from a DNA test that she was not her father's daughter. And that's the subject of her new book, Inheritance. Mm. And she was kind of surprised that I started with that. and I think it was kind of like a fun moment because that's what I'm obsessed with. That's my interest, right? And that makes me maybe a little strange, but definitely unique as an interviewer. And so we got into some really interesting territory in that very brief interview. I think it does. I think it works.
Now, throughout this entire show, I've picked up on threads of your professional personality, at least, as far as the community, the promotion, the evaluation, the ability to communicate, which leads me to the fact that you're a publicist, and that now makes an incredible amount of sense. What does being a publicist entail, and how did you get into, you know, doing publicity for authors and artists in general?
So I grew up in New York and New Jersey, and my mom ran a public relations agency in New York that was quite big and successful, and they had a lot of fancy clients. And they launched a book division when I was sort of just out of college. So my first job was working for her. She partnered with a really well-known agent, and we represented their authors. And this was like in the late 90s before social media. So I learned just like, I mean, I was basically apprenticed, you know, by my mom and being in the business. And then I started a company when I moved to Houston. So I had this crazy religious conversion, got married and moved to Houston, Texas, and, you know, realized like, oh, actually I need to eat. We need to pay our bills. And that was always something that I knew how to do. You know, it's a skill that I know how to get paid to do. So I started a company and it was really successful. And then I had like a huge existential crisis, as I seem to be want to do, and made a left turn into the church. I started a music ministry career and that, you know, and then I've come back to publicity now as I'm getting ready to launch a book. Because I know how, again, because I know how to do it, right? I know how to do it. I'm good at it. And you know, I have a kid and she like needs new sneakers. So I like, I have to work. Right. And also I really enjoy, helping artists, like mirroring back to them their goals in a way that makes their goals seem attainable and reasonable and not some crazy pie in the sky thing. Because really for almost any goal, there are a series of steps and strategies that you can take to reach it. And it's not magical, you know? And I think publicity is really magical in the minds of a lot of artists because they don't know how it works. And I know how it works. So I feel like that's something I can share with people and help them, you know, again, while, you know, trying to keep up with my daughter's shoe habit.
Right.
So.
Well, that, and that really, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head, is that there's, for almost any big goal, there is a series of steps and strategies you can then apply. And I think, like you were talking about with publicity, when artists, I find a lot of times say, well, I'm not really good at the marketing myself stuff. I'm just going to write, you put it out and you do it. And I'm just going to sit back here and be the artist. In reality, they're confused a lot of times and don't really know what it entails.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And I think the publicity is really the kind of the magic thing in their eyes. They don't know where to start, what to do. So for anybody who's listening, and not asking you to give away your trade secrets, obviously, but for anybody who's listening who maybe is trying to promote something, what advice would you give them if they're kind of stuck in that, I don't know where to start, I don't know what to do promoting this? Could you offer any ways?
Absolutely.
Thoughts?
Yeah. I think that this is what social media is really used best for, is promoting work by independent artists. And it goes back to that question of community. You know, invest in your community, share other people's work, ask them to share your work. I mean, that's an easy, quick thing that we can all do. You know, another really simple thing that artists need to do is they need to get their website sorted out so that it looks clean and beautiful. And that is really easy to do. Like, there's great resources out there. Squarespace is one of them. It's like $17 a month. Like, go design a beautiful website. Take the time to get your website looking like you want to be represented, and then just line up your social media so that your Twitter, your Facebook, and your Instagram is all connected. So you don't have to think about a separate post for each. Like, create a unified platform where everything is shared across each platform, and make it clean and make it beautiful in terms of the way that you present it. And that's like an easy thing, because we're all like checking each other out all the time. You know, like, you Googled me, you looked at my essay, like, we're all looking at the way that we represent ourselves online. And so when someone wants to write about your book, for example, if you're an artist or an author and you want to publicize your book and you don't know where to start, if a reviewer hears about it and is interested, they're going to suss you out online. So start there and just clean it up, connect it, make it a simple tool that you can use. And the other thing is, like, when you're using social media, use it with community in mind. Don't get on there and just amplify, I have a new book out, I have a new essay out, I have a new song out, I have a new, like, have conversation, share other people's work, you know, but please don't get dragged into the undertow, because we know what that is, especially on Twitter, right? It's easy to get swept away and overwhelmed and carried away, but there are tools for managing that. Like, you can use tools to manage Twitter, tools to manage Instagram, and Facebook, just so that you can use it in a way that's healthy for you, but that is getting your stuff out there. But I think the first step is community. It's investing in other people and sharing other people's work, being a good literary citizen. I think that's a really good place to start. And advocating for yourself, you know, saying to someone whose work you admire, hey, I'm going to write a review of your book, is that cool? You know, and then when you have a book coming out, hey, would you consider reviewing my book? You know, or going to the editor that ran the review and ask that editor, you know, hey, you ran my review of Cliff's book, would you run a review of my book? You know, that's hard. That's the hardest part, is saying, like, hey, I did this thing. You know, I know you know me in this way, but could you, that's hard, but you have to do it. You have to do it for yourself. Amen. You have to do it for yourself.
Amen. Amen.
Well, I think one of the things you're saying that seemed, sorry to cut you off here, Cliff. One of the things you're saying, I think that we both talk about, Cliff and I both talk about a lot, which is leading with value in relationships first. And it's not that you're giving to get something 100%. Like you've said, but it is just showing up and saying, hey, I'm here to help all of us. I'm here to support you. I'm here because I love this as well. And that really does seem to be one of the big powerful kind of strategies that, but it has to be authentic, but it's one of the powerful strategies that I think I see a lot of people neglecting, but the people who are really paying attention to it derive a lot of value out of it. And Cliff, you're one of the great people to talk to about that as well. Yeah, but I think we're all kind of on the same page. And so I hope everyone listening is getting this leading with value before asking for it, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a great way to kind of find your tribe, you know, your kind of group of weirdos who are writing about the same stuff you're writing about or singing about the same stuff you're singing about. Like when you were talking about your experience with singing for funerals, I was thinking about my friend Lauren DiPino, who is a writer out of LA, who is she's a funeral singer. And she's, you know, an essayist and writing op-eds and publishing and stuff like that. But it's like, we are out there. Like there are people who have this experience who are writing about it. And it's really edifying to find people that you can talk to about trying to make art out of this strange thing that you do. And that's how you do it, is by helping other people and, you know, promoting their stuff and starting conversation. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I have to ask, I heard you talk about, you know, growing up in the New York, New Jersey area, and now you live in Houston. And I'd be remiss if I didn't touch upon how did that, and I think from what I read, you moved just after or around the 9/11.
Yeah. After.
How did that move impact your writing and your music?
You know, I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Honestly, I have regretted it. Believe me, I have spent time like wondering, like, was this so smart? but I think it was for me the right thing to do. I think I had to get into a smaller pond where I could find community and build community. I had a really great thing going on in New York when I left. I had a development deal with Warner Brothers. I had like my first album came out and that I ended up putting out myself. And, you know, it was happening. It wasn't like it wasn't happening. But I don't know. I think maybe I freaked out, you know. Also 9/11 really, really shattered me for many reasons. But it was, again, it was that question of like, you know, what is the value in my life? Is the value in my life being an ambitious artist? Like, do I want to be a star? Is that what I'm after? Or like, do I want to spend my life doing something that I think matters, like for other people and maybe not just for myself? So those were kind of like the big, you know, 25-year-old thoughts I was having when I left New York. But Houston has been really, really good to me. Houston is a very unique city in Texas in that it is incredibly international. It's incredibly cosmopolitan. You know, we have like the most, it is truly, literally, and I'm not saying this is not a hyperbole, it's the most diverse city in the United States. We have the most languages spoken here. Like I'm really proud of Houston. I'm really proud of especially how well it's recovered post Hurricane Harvey. So, right. but I have built community here, and that has given me the safety from which to explore art. Know that like, even if I fell on my face, I would still have community and I would still have friends. And I had people who care about me and care about my work as an artist. And that was really built through the church. I mean, through my work, as a music minister here, you know, that's how I met everyone that I knew. And since then, you know, it's expanded to the literary community and the art community and people just really help each other out here. And it's amazing. It's wonderful. And I'm really glad to be here. It's hot as hell. it's hot as hell right now. And you know, it's, there's terrible air pollution. The mosquitoes are awful, but the people are great. And, yeah, like I put out a country, like a country folk album. Like, who am I? Like, I'm like a Jew from New York. I mean, I am a Jew from New York, but I've been living in Texas long enough that I felt like I could put out an album of Patsy Cline covers. So, I mean,
totally authentic at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Like that's something. I mean,
that's nothing. That's great. And I think, you know, it, you know, Cameron, I'm someone as well who, you know, like I said, I write, I put out albums, I do podcasts, I do all this stuff. So I can kind of understand what it is to jump between project to project to project, because it kind of is what is feels right at the time. You kind of, there is that ebb and flow. But it reminded me of a clip from the often quoted Kanye West, which I know lots of people love to hate and some people just love. But I remember seeing an interview once where someone asked him, you know, you design clothes, you do music, you do all these things. How do you keep it all straight in your head? And his response was, because I think everything is the same thing. And I really sat up and said, that's exactly how I feel about this. But I wanted to throw out and ask you, what do you think about that statement?
I think Kanye has his moments.
Really, yeah. He does.
He has his moments. He really does. It is the same thing. Of course it's the same thing. I mean, it's coming from the same place. It's, you're just one person, you know? And I really, you know, we have, there's so many strong myths about what is it to be an artist that can be so damning and so, you know, paralyzing. And one of those myths is that you can only be one great thing. You know, you can never be great if you're doing all of the things. So you have to pick one thing and become great at the one thing.
Very true.
Which is, when I say it out loud, I mean, it sounds crazy.
Boring. You know, and boring. It's almost like this is, I mean, it's almost, I have to like hold my hand over my mouth to keep from talking about it, because the myths, and I'm not trying to end on a negative note, but like the not sharing and this hermetic life with no friends, and I'm introverted and can't talk to people. I'm not launching an attack against people who are quieter and more to themselves, but there is a pervasive, one of those damning myths that if you're not miserable and in the midst of an addiction and loathsome of yourself and others, if you're not in that nasty mind space, then you won't make it. And I have found that if you're in that headspace, you will not make it.
Okay, you're right. Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, it's kind of it's a gatekeeper thing. It's a bit of a, you know, a weird self-selection thing, you know, because if you think about it, I mean, people who believe that and quit, well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. If I thought that was true, I would quit as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not true. And I don't know anyone like that that's a successful artist. I mean, art is a business. I mean, you know, so, but then of course, you know, those of us who are Gen X or are older, but definitely Gen Xers. I don't think millennials have this problem, but we were like, don't sell out, you know, like the man, you know, we were so like anti-establishment in our establishmentism, right? Like we were like mass produced flannel shirts and mass produced angst is what we gave the world, really.
Yeah.
And so I really struggled with that. I mean, in my 20s and 30s, early 30s, but really, really struggle with that idea of like, am I a real artist if I am making money at this? Or am I a real artist and I'm not making money at this? Or you know, we always have, there's always a reason to like tell myself that I'm not good enough. And some of that is just me, but some of that is our culture that, you know, has all these crazy myths that we unknowingly, you know, repeat and carry forward. But it's really good to say otherwise and to have a podcast where you tell people you don't have to be miserable to be an artist.
I think that's such a huge, it's such a huge thing. There was the thing that really blew my mind was, you know, I always had people referring to, you know, me, and I know other people, I'm sure you've heard this too, both of you have, the jack of all trades, master of none thing that's thrown out. Now, that's almost said in a kind of derogatory way from people, or at least I hear it that way. But the funny thing is when I found out the actual origin of that quote, and I don't know if you know this, is a jack of all trades, master of none is many times better than a master of one. And I was like, Well, that second half completely flips everything on his head, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And yes, thank you very much. I do think it does help, by the way, having game disciplines, you know? And, and I think anything we can do to burst those myths that are just counterproductive and keep people from wanting to or feeling capable of creating and stepping out and putting it out into the world is something that's very valuable.
I mean, with that said, there is also avoidance, you know, we also have avoidance. So it is easy when you can do multiple things to like avoid finishing the novel because you decided to start painting
avoid,
you know, so you have to watch it in yourself. I mean, I have to watch it in myself and finishing something is the discipline like that. That is the art. I mean, of all things is like, can you finish a draft of this thing?
The most painful thing. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole thing. So yeah, I'm with you on that for sure.
That's great. Cliff, what do you think?
I've had, recent breakthroughs and, overcoming it is I get energized when I hear people talk about their open relationship with God, and it's more like me being selfish in the moment of it doesn't make me nervous either, you know, because typically religion and politics, those are two things that, and I know it's not just local to we three. I mean, it's like people will immediately get kind of, oh God. You know, it's just, where's this going to go? And it's, I'm just sitting here thinking and about this show in particular, and just what I take away from it is this, it never got uncomfortable and it never got tense. And that's what I want to share more of. And I think it's neat that none of us knew that all of us kind of stood on the same ground where that's concerned. And it all goes back to what Cameron was saying in the very beginning about, you know, promoting other like minds and I don't believe there are any coincidences in the universe, you know, not to get all metaphysical woo-woo on you right now, but, you know, that was one of the things to take away. It makes me extremely happy. And then to kind of, you know, kind of ducktail that with, you know, you don't have to be miserable and withdrawn to be a success, nor do you have to pick one lot in life, and it's not selfish to want other things.
Right.
It's gratitude and plenty that I like.
Yeah, you know,
I truly enjoy that.
I don't know if you know there's a Texan folk singer named Ray Wiley Hubbard. You guys know Ray Wiley Hubbard? You heard of him?
That name is so familiar.
Yeah, he's a legend. But he came to perform at a concert series that I was running at St. Mark's Episcopal Church here in Houston. And he said many brilliant things, but he said, you know, his life's philosophy is to keep his expectations low and his gratitude high.
Oh, I love it.
You know,
it.
And it's like, really, if you can, even if you can just try that, like approaching that and failing is better than the alternative, you know?
Right. Agreed.
You know, so.
Well, it's like taking the at bats. I think that's a big thing is that you keep going up there, taking the at bat, whether or not you hit the home run or not is kind of, you don't need to live and die on that, but you need to continually try to improve and continually take the chances. But then the gratitude is such an important part that would keep you going back to that.
Yeah.
And I love that. That's actually makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Love Ray Wiley.
Well, I think gratitude is probably a great place for us to leave this.
I agree.
And Cameron, I just want to say thanks so much for taking the time. And, you know, of course, I will put links to your book. I'll put links to your website and everything in the show notes. If anybody wants to check out Cameron, we definitely, definitely recommend it. Thank you once again. Cliff, do you have anything to add before we wrap it up?
No, I mean, I'm afraid I'm going to break out into song, and I swear to you both, it's awful when I do. So we'll sign off now and save all the trouble.
All right. Thank you guys so much. It was great. Great talking to you.
A pleasure, Cameron. All right. Thank you. All right, everyone. Cliff and I both want to thank you for spending your time with us. We also want to say thank you to the wonderful Cameron Deason Hammond for the great interview. Her book comes out here on October 22nd of this year. We're going to be putting a link to her website in the show notes. The music for this episode was, of course, provided by the incredible Justin Johnson. You can find him at justinjohnsonlive.com. If you want to find Clifford Brooks, you can find him at thesoutherncollectiveexperience.com. If you want to find me, Michael Amadei, you can find me at worldpoetryopenmic.net or at michaelamadei.com. And
until next time, we love you and keep being creative.